Thank you, everybody. My name is Jim Carson. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
My sobriety date is August 17th of 2012. My home group is the Gracious Living Group out of Smithfield. We're in the Ben's Church. We meet on Wednesday nights at 7:30. So if you're ever out that way, come on in, drop in and visit with us. We'd be glad to have you. I do sponsor people. I have a sponsor, and I do service work for my home group. I think that's important. One of the things I've learned through my ins and outs of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I get out of this program what I put into it. And you'll hear a little bit later in my story, there were times when I wasn't a contributing member. I was just there, and it didn't end well for me. So, and I'll get to that in a little bit. A little bit about me. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My father was in the military, and we moved around quite a bit. He was career military. As a matter of fact, my mom was military as well. That's how they met. So I've always admired people that are in the military, you know, strong work ethic, high moral standards. But they do tend to work hard and play hard as well. And that's a little bit, I think that tempered my early perceptions of alcohol. My grandfather was also retired military. And when he got out of the military, he got a job working for the Duquesne Brewery in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My earliest memories are going down to his basement to play, and he had beer stacked up from floor to ceiling because they used to give him free beer as an employee. I can remember sitting there watching the Pirates play. You know, he was a big Pittsburgh Pirates fan and would be sitting there watching the games on TV. And he'd have a bottle of beer and a bag of pretzels, and I'd have my little cup of beer and pretzels, and we'd just sit there and eat pretzels and drink beer and watch the game together. So I wasn't afraid of alcohol. As a matter of fact, I just saw alcohol as part of life. It was something I wanted to do. I used to go to weddings up in Pittsburgh, and I'd drink cream soda because when you poured it in a glass, you know, talking little kid here, when you poured it in a glass, it looked like beer. And I could pretend that I was drinking beer just like my uncles and my grandfather and my mom and my dad. So I wouldn't say that I was obsessed with alcohol, but I will say it was part of my life as long as I can remember. My family didn't make me an alcoholic. I had a wonderful relationship with my father. When he was around, again, he was in the service during the Vietnam era, so he would go overseas a lot, and every time he went overseas, it was places I couldn't go. So we would go back home to Pittsburgh to stay with my mom's family. But when he was around, we were inseparable. I loved my dad to no end. When I decided I wanted to be a Boy Scout, he became the Boy Scout leader for the entire Air Force base so that we could spend more time together and do things together. So my childhood with my parents was wonderful. So I can't blame any of my disease on anything I was deprived of as a child. We didn't move around a lot, you know, being military, so every couple of years I had to change places and make new friends. My friends were, even when I wasn't the one moving, a lot of times my friends would move away. But I actually thought traveling around and getting to see a lot of different places was pretty cool. I did, like I said, I moved around a lot. I went through to 8 different schools in the 12 years that I was growing up, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade. So I was constantly being introduced into new environments. And I found out at a fairly young age that one of the things that enabled me to blend in or make friends more easily was alcohol. You know, you moved into a new area. If you drank or did drugs, you fit right in with at least one group of people right out of the gate. And you became friends with them. I can remember the first time I drank enough to make a difference. And what I mean by that is the first time I drank enough to get drunk. I was walking home, taking a shortcut through the backwoods down at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in North Carolina. I was 15 years old. I found a cold six-pack of Schlitz that somebody had hidden behind the youth center. And I figured finders keepers. So I took it and I just sat down and drank the whole thing in one shot. And I loved the feeling it gave me. I always felt like there was something that was just a little bit off with me, that I wasn't quite as good as everybody else. And again, there was no reason for me to feel that way, but the reality was I did. I felt like I just didn't quite measure up. That first drink of alcohol, that first drunk, took all of that away. And I loved the feeling, and I pursued it from that point on. I drank alcoholically. Again, 15-year-old, it was a little bit difficult for me to get beer or any other kind of liquor. But again, this was back during the Vietnam War. Three of my best friends were from Southeast Asia. Back then, they didn't have bilingual schools. When they came in to our school system, they had to stay in English classes long enough for them to function in a normal classroom. So I'm 15. My friends are 18. My friends are old enough to buy alcohol. And on an Air Force base, you can buy liquor at 18. So I had that going for me right out of the gate too. But I can remember, I never drank socially after that first six-pack of beer, and I got in trouble for that right out of the gate too. I mean, the first time I drank, I got in trouble because my father knew I'd been drinking. And unfortunately, that began the rift between me and my dad. And again, I'll get to talk more about that in a little bit. But once I had that feeling, once I had that alcohol in me, it made me feel like I was on top of the world. I could do anything. I could talk to any girl. I could play any sport. I was better at everything I wanted to do. And I pursued that feeling every opportunity I had. If I couldn't get together with my friends and we couldn't go out and buy it, I would go in and raid my father's liquor cabinet. Those of you that are old enough may remember the Tupperware glasses. They were about that big. They had a top on them. I used to go in there and mix a little bit of everything he had into that one of those glasses because I didn't want him to see that it was going down. It tasted like crap. I mean, it tasted horrible. But I drank it because I was drinking for the effect. That's all. I mean, right out of the gate, I was drinking for effect. Didn't care how it tasted. Didn't care if I was drinking alone. Didn't care if I was with my friends. I was drinking because it made me feel better about myself. I also started having problems right out of the gate. I remember I used to drink to blackout at 15. I mean, right when I started. And I didn't realize that was a problem. I thought that blacking out was a normal part of drinking. You know, you drank, you blacked out. I didn't know that I didn't know that blackout scared the hell out of normal drinkers. I just thought it was part of the game. I can remember early on waking up in a camper in somebody's yard, and the old guy was out there mowing his lawn. And I had no idea where I was. I waited till he went in. I, you know, ran out, ran down the road, and I'm in the middle of tobacco country, North Carolina. No idea where I was. Turns out I had met a girl, decided going home with her would be a good idea. Somehow or other, I ended up in her camper, and that's where I stayed. And that's not normal behavior for a 15-year-old kid. But again, I didn't see that as being a problem. I really didn't. My high school yearbook is, if you go back, and I moved here in my senior year, so my high school yearbook in my junior year when I was moving up, you know, it's to Jim the alcoholic, come back, we'll party. To Jim, I'm going to miss you. You know, come on back, we'll have some more time, good times. You know, to Jim, the alcoholic, don't drink too much, don't get in trouble, and I'll see you soon. And at the time, I kind of took that as a badge of honor, because I could out-drink all my buddies. I would not puke. I would not pass out. I'd black out, but I wouldn't pass out, which, again, is kind of scary, because I'd just keep going. but I wouldn't pass out, and I wore that as a badge of honor. What I did, and I didn't have a problem admitting I was an alcoholic, even in my when I came into my adulthood, because I didn't understand what that was. I didn't know at the time that alcoholism was a progressive and fatal disease that was going to rob me of everything I cared about before it killed me. That's my definition of alcoholism is a progressive and fatal disease that's going to take everything you care about and then kill you. But again, I didn't know that at the time. So I moved up here in my senior year of high school. Didn't know anybody because of the courses I had been taking in North Carolina. I got permission to go to a different school. So even the kids I met on base were not the kids I was going to school with. So I was, again, senior year of high school, brand new faces, brand new people. I'm the new kid. So I resorted to what I always did. I fell in with the party crowd, started drinking with them. And I'll tell you, they party a lot harder here than they did back in North Carolina. I mean, it was, and the teachers didn't seem to really care, I guess because I was a senior and I was a new kid. In North Carolina, when the bell rang, if you drove your car into the parking lot, they locked the gate and you didn't get out unless you went and saw the principal. Up here, you just left. And because the requirements for graduation were different than here than there, I had to take two study halls and two gym classes because in North Carolina, gym was optional. Here was a requirement for graduation. So I had these classes that I really didn't care anything about. So I tell my gym teacher I was going to do electronics, which was my real passion. And I tell my study hall teacher that I was going to go do another project, and I would just skip school. We'd go up. It's now a park, Sandy Bottoms. I went to Bethel. That used to be where we would go to party. I mean, at the time, it was just a big gravel pit that had filled up with water, and we'd go out there and just hang out, drink beer. I'd go back to class drunk. I mean, drunk, not just a little buzz, drunk, and nobody seemed to care. So then I met a girl. I met a girl that I wanted to be involved with. She was an athlete. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, she didn't party. So I misrepresented myself to her. I came across as this guy that, you know, I drank some, but I didn't have a problem. I became who I thought she would want me to be so that I could get to know her better. Long story short, I was working a 3 to midnight shift, and she was still going to school. So we didn't see each other that much. When she saw me, I was sober, or at least I hadn't been drinking. What she didn't know was when I'd get off work, I had all kinds of stuff in my apartment that I would just go home and just drink until it was time to get up again the next day. So she really didn't know who I was. We dated for a while. I talked her into marrying me. We got married. And when we first got married, I didn't have a whole lot of money, so I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. But I had friends. My friends used to come by, and we would just party to the point where I was basically wasted, and she would get upset with that. And then I would do things again. I was still blacking out. That hadn't changed. So I'd black out, and I'd wake up in the morning. She'd say, "Do you remember what you did last night?" And I'm like, "No." She said, "Well, you need to think long and hard about it because you made an ass out of yourself." And I'm like, "What did I do?" I had no idea. Once we got married, I would start coming to in the mornings, and the house would be empty. It would be dark. The kids would be gone. And I'd be sitting there thinking, "What did I do last night?" And I wouldn't remember. I'd ask them. She'd say, "I'm not going to tell you. You need to think about it and figure it out." No matter how hard I tried, I could not figure it out. Along about that time, I started having, and again, that's when it started having consequence. Before that time, you know, I had a couple of run-ins with the law. I had a number of small accidents where I had been drinking, but for whatever reason, the police never thought to question me or breathalyze me. So again, no consequence, no reason to change. I actually was coming onto the Air Force Base one time, and I had a mixed drink between my legs, and security officer said, "What's in the cup?" I said, "Orange juice." He said, "I don't think it's orange juice." I said, "Do you want a taste?" He said, "Get out there, go. Just go on through. I don't want to mess with you." A friend of mine, we went out to see who could drink each other out of under the table in my car. So I asked him, I said, I need to take a break. How about you drive? He drove us up onto somebody's front porch. They all come piling out of the house. Fortunately, the car started. We backed down, and I drove away. No consequence. However, after I was married, I got my first DUI. I'll tell you, if it weren't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of my higher power, who I call God, I would not be standing here before you today. My first DUI, I was coming home, and Victoria Boulevard in Hampton makes a sharp turn as you come from the Oaks towards Buck Road. The road turned, I didn't turn. My car went up on the median, doing about 40 miles an hour, and it slid along the median instead of jumping the median and going head on into the other lane. When the police came, I'm sitting there trying to get my car off the curb. They asked me if I'd been drinking. I said, yes, I had. They asked me if I wanted to be breathalyzed or have blood drawn, and I'm thinking I'm going to put as much time between my drugs, where I was at that moment in time, and me having to be tested. So I said, I want blood drawn. I went in, I'm reading all the papers that they're handing me, I'm stalling as much as I can. Finally, they draw my blood. They used to have, I guess they still have VASAP, I don't know, the Virginia Alcohol Safety and Awareness Program, but I had to go in and talk to a counselor, an intake counselor for that. She wanted to involuntarily commit me. My blood alcohol content at the time of my arrest was so high that they were afraid if I tried to quit drinking on my own, I'd go into DTs and die. And she said, and not only that, but by the police report, you were coherent, you were rational, you were talking, you were reading the documents, you were asking questions that were rational. She said, you've got a severe drug and alcohol problem. I said, I can't be involuntarily committed. I'll lose my job. By this time, I had three kids. I've got three kids and a wife. So I talked them out of committing me. Again, no consequence. They said I had to go to AA meetings. I went to a few AA meetings. Really didn't want what you guys were peddling. So I found out pretty early on I could sign my own slips. And I actually used going to AA meetings as an excuse to get out of the house and drink. Turned in my slips. Nobody ever asked me any questions about it. Got my license back. Jim was good. Excuse me. I often wonder what it had been like if it had taken a different turn, because that was back in the early 1980s. And had the consequences been severe enough to get me to change at that point in time, I would have saved myself a lot of pain later on down the road. But again, I managed to skate through that. Wasn't 3 months later, I had another accident, this one with injuries. Somebody, I was making a left-hand turn with a green light. Somebody ran a red light and T-boned me. Unfortunately for me, I had been drinking. I was well above the legal limit again. But for some reason, the officer never asked me if I'd been drinking, never breathalyzed me. I went into court. They actually charged me with failure to yield the right of way, and I went into court and I said, I had the right of way. You know, why did I have to yield it? And the judge agreed with me and let me go. Again, no consequence. So I continued on drinking, got my second DUI. This one really hurt. This is where things started getting bad. I was coming home from Smithfield, and I had been drinking. I had my three daughters in the car. They were like 12, 10, and 8 at the time. Pull up to a sobriety checkpoint, and I figured I hadn't had that much to drink. I'm going to be good. State trooper asked me to get out of the car, does a sobriety test. I thought I passed it. He asked me to, you know, he said he wanted me to be breathalyzed, and I blew 0.08, which at the time was under the limit of 0.1. So I'm like, I'm out of here. He's like, no, I don't think so. Get in the car. He said, we set these low. I think if I take you to the station, you're going to go blow higher. So he handcuffed me, put me in the car, drove me off, left my three kids, 12, 10, and 8, sitting in the car on the side of Route 10. Fortunately, my next door neighbor, or the guy that lived one house down, was a Smithfield cop. And as they were booking me in, you know, I said, Billy, can you please go get my kids and take them home and hold them until I can get out? Because by this time, my wife and I were separated. I had no idea how to get in touch with her. I had no idea what had happened to my kids. All I knew was that, you know, I had really screwed up. I had royally screwed up. But oddly enough, I went into court, got a lawyer, and through the miracle of modern justice, I actually got my second first offense. So again, they suspended my license, but they allowed me to drive back and forth to work. So not a whole lot of consequence. But that did set the wheels in motion. In 1989, Labor Day weekend, came home, we're sitting there eating dinner. My wife looks at me while we're eating dinner at the dinner table and says, I've decided I don't want to be married to you anymore. I've packed your bag. After dinner, I would like you to leave. And I didn't respond as calmly as she said that. Thank God I didn't hit her. Punched some holes in the wall, used a bunch of language, but I did. I packed my bags and I left, and we separated. Called a friend of mine, an old high school drinking buddy, one of the ones I was running with at Bethel every day. And he had hit bottom about a year before me. And I said, Ross, I don't know what you did. Whatever you did, I need to do. I said, I cannot keep living the way I am. I can't stand the person I've become. And he came over, and I was afraid, because of my job, I was afraid to go to meetings in Smithfield. So this man would drive from Phoebus to Smithfield, would catch the ferry over to Surrey, would go to Eastern State. He did this like three times a week, every week for a couple of months. And he finally said, Jim, you just need to grow up. Man up, go find yourself a sponsor in Smithfield, start working the program in Smithfield, find a home group and work the program. Which is what I did. I came in, found a sponsor, started working the steps with that sponsor. Within a relatively short period of time, that overwhelming compulsion to drink every day went away. I found that as long as I went to meetings, worked the steps, talked to my sponsor, did my daily routine of prayer and meditation, that obsession to drink stayed at bay. I didn't have that. I had about a little over a year of sobriety under my belt when I was at a meeting one day, and somebody said something that upset me. It tweaked my pride. And I'm thinking to myself, I've been at this for better than a year. I haven't had a drink in a year. I've got the big book. I'm praying to God. I've got this. And I left. I just quit going to meetings. Quit talking to my sponsor. Shortly thereafter, I quit saying my prayers, quit doing the daily meditation. Not too long after that, the insanity returned and I started drinking. And I stayed out. I tried, and I desperately wanted to quit. I was too prideful to go back in and admit I screwed up. But damn it, I was going. I had a year of sobriety under my belt, and I knew I could do it again. And I spent the next 15 years every day swearing that I wouldn't drink. And almost every day I drank. 7 o'clock in the morning, I would leave money at home so that I wouldn't have money to buy anything on the way home from work. And now I'm a supervisor. I'm going around bumming money off the people that work for me so that I can get something to drink on the way home. I mean, how demeaning is that? And I did that for years, and I could not stop no matter how badly I wanted. But I was too proud to ask for help. Until one day, 15 years later, I had gotten to the point where I didn't know what else to do. I was dying. I was literally laying in bed, and it may have been a hallucination, may have been DTs, but I heard a voice in my head, clear as a bell, said, "You need to go back to AA." You know, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm laying there, you know, shaking, sweating. I'm supposed to be going to work, but I'm in no condition to go to work. "You need to go back to AA." So I went down, looked on the computer. There was an AA meeting that night at Ben's church. And I showed up there. But by the time I got there, I'm like, I'll go to the meeting. Maybe I'm making too big a deal out of this. I'm going to go. I'm going to sit in the back. I'll listen. If I hear somebody say something that engages me, I'll go up and I'll get involved and I'll get back into this thing. If not, I'll just keep on trying on my own. But like I said, my higher power had a different idea. I walked in, and there was no back of the room. There were only four people there, one of whom was my sponsor from 15 years earlier, and he recognized me. and he just walked up, and he gave me a big hug. And he said, "Jim, I'm glad you're still alive. I've been worried about you." He said, "How about if we go and have some coffee after the meeting?" And I said, "Bill, I'd really like that." And we did. So I started working the steps with my sponsor again. Very similar results, you know, after a short period of time, working the steps with a sponsor, praying, going to meetings, doing meditation, talking with God. The overwhelming compulsion to drink, which I had been unable to stop on my own, with everything I had, I could not stop. Within a short period of time, that compulsion went away. And I had a really, you know, my life was back together. Me and my wife had gotten we went to counseling. We were back together. My kids were back with me. Things were picking up on my job because, you know, it wasn't looking too good on the job for a while. But everything came back in, and my life was really starting to look pretty presentable. I was happy. I was free. I didn't have to drink. I had a choice. And then my sponsor moved. My father died. My mother got ill. And I was spending every weekend, you know, driving up to Pennsylvania, staying in a hotel. And I could have gone to meetings up there. But I rationalized, you know, I'm really busy. I'm spending all the time I can with her because she's really sick. And again, stopped calling my sponsor, stopped going to meetings, stopped saying the prayers, and the insanity returned. And for me, the insanity is not what I was doing while I was drinking, because I was under the influence of drugs. You know, alcohol is a drug. To me, the insanity was I was able to convince myself it was going to be different this time than it had been all the other times. This time I was going to just have a couple of beers. And then I'd go back to Smithfield and nobody would know. And I'd be able to just continue life, you know, the way it was. The reality was, and this shows you how insane I really was. In Pennsylvania at the time, unless you went to a bar, you couldn't buy a bottle of beer. You had to go to a party store and buy a case. I didn't want to go to a bar because I'd already had two DUIs and I didn't want to get a third. So I went to a party store, bought a case, telling myself I'm only going to drink two or three, and I'll just leave the, I'm going to leave the rest. And it sounds funny, but I, honest to God, that was my intent when I bought that. It didn't work out that way. And I wasn't able to return to Smithfield and pick my life up where it left off, because once I crossed that line, again, it's like it says in the book, once I started drinking again, I was off to the races. Fortunately, though, this time, the first time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it took me over 20 years before I was willing to ask for help. The second time, it took me 15 years before it beat me to the point where I was willing to ask for help. This time, within 2 years, I was right back where I was. And I was just miserable. I was physically, mentally, and spiritually sick. I didn't know what to do. You know, I put my life back together, and here I was throwing it away again. So I came back in. I looked in the mirror and just decided that I would do whatever it took. So I went back into the rooms, looked around, and found what I thought was going to be the biggest, meanest guy in the room to be my sponsor. I now know he's a big teddy bear, but you know, at the time, Steve was pretty intimidating to me. Not that Steve Showalter. He just seemed like this grumpy guy that would call me on my BS. So I figured he's the kind of guy I needed. I needed somebody that would hold me accountable to working the steps of the program, to doing what needed to be done, to being honest with myself and being honest with others. And that's where I was, you know, on August 17th of 2012. That's what I brought into AA. So that's what it was like. I told you guys what happened on a number of occasions, but since that time, my life has turned around in so many ways. I mean, just, it's unbelievable the changes that have occurred in my life since that time. I actually, I've had an opportunity to do so many cool things. Well, first, my relationship with my wife has healed. So I'm still married to the same woman that I married 43 years ago. That in and of itself is a miracle. And we're happy, which is an even bigger miracle. I managed to retire from my position. And in the job I had, we had on-site drug and alcohol testing. Not only did they have initial drug screens and alcohol screens, they had for-cause testing if somebody suspected that you were not fit for duty. And they had, or something happened, and you know, if there was any kind of an event, they would just automatically test you to see if drugs or alcohol was causal. And they had random testing. You know, if you were on site, they had your badge number, they just pull random badge numbers, and if your number was called, you had to go in, you know, do the breathalyzer and pee in the bottle. And if you refused, it was an automatic positive, and you were terminated on the spot. How I survived in that environment for all those years, I don't know. But I did. I did. And I actually finished out my career on a very strong note. I was a department head, and the people that worked for me hated me because I was a drunk asshole. Excuse my French. I was a drunk boss that didn't want to be responsible for his people. I just wanted to be left alone. You know, I had my own issues that I was trying to deal with, and I really didn't want to be the type of supervisor that they needed. I came into the program, started working the steps. I became a better boss, became a better husband, better father. When I retired, some of the same people that I worked for when I was actively drinking came up to me and said, "We don't know what happened to you, but I just want to let you know. When we heard that you were going to be our boss again, we were thinking about changing careers." But we've got to tell you that you've turned out to be one of the best bosses we've ever had. And I said, I just don't live the way I used to. I said, I found a different way of living. And that's why I'm not the person I used to be. This program has given me that different way of living. I now know that the reason I could not stop drinking on my own, and I heard somebody say it at the meeting the other day, when I was drinking, I was angry, irritable, and discontented. When I quit drinking, I became more angry, irritable, and discontented. My pattern was I would drink until I had to stop, and then I would stop till I had to drink. And then I would drink till I had to stop, I would stop till I had to drink. And I could never figure out how to break that cycle on my own. It took coming into the rooms, admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, and asking for help. And what I got when I did that is a life that is just amazing. Like I said, my wife and I are together. My kids and I have reconciled. I've managed to retire from that career. So now we're getting to spend time traveling. One of the things my father and I loved to do when I was a kid with him is build and fly model airplanes. I've actually started doing that again with my grandson, who's never seen me drunk. None of my grandkids have seen me drunk. And I do it competitively. I'm traveling around the country competing with other people and learning how to do these things and just having a blast. I mean, it is so much fun. Like I said, I've got the opportunity to now to work with other people. I've sponsored a number of people, and I've got sponsees now. And being a positive influence in their life is the most rewarding thing I've ever done. You know, when I've had the opportunity to be a small part, and it's not me, it's them and God that have worked the miracle, but I've been able to help in that process, and knowing that I was able to help save somebody's life is a pretty incredible feeling, and that's really what I believe we're dealing with here in Alcoholics Anonymous is we are saving lives. Because with the accidents I've had in my automobile and the way that I used to drink, if I hadn't come in here and found y'all, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. There's not a doubt in my mind. I'd either be locked up or dead, one of the two. I would not be here enjoying the life that I've been given by this program. Let's see what time it is. Just about time for me to wrap it up, so I think I'll stop there. One thing I did learn is through all my trials and tribulations, I do think that God works through the people in these rooms. And I think when I went out on my own and tried to do it on my own, I was cutting myself out from God's help. I need him working through the people in this program to tell me what I need to hear, to keep me on the right path, to give me encouragement when I'm faltering, to be there when things aren't going good. In sobriety, I've had a house burn down. I've had some pretty disquieting medical information. But, you know, you guys have showed me a way of dealing with these things. I now have tools. You know, before I didn't have the tools to deal with these kind of life events. I do now. I know that by myself, I can't do it. With the help of the people in these rooms, I can. I know that it's the feeling I get being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and being able to help others is a feeling that I can't even describe. It really is amazing. And I've got friends now, real friends. Friends that when something happens, you know, they say, we're going to be there. We're going to be there. When the house had burned, it was down in North Carolina. And they're like, we're going to be there. You know, and I'm like, you really don't need to come. There's nothing. No, we're going to be there. We'll be there in about 5 hours because that's how long it's going to take to go down there. I never had friends like that drinking. So the biggest thing is, I've learned that I need to stay connected to the Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to participate because I get out of it what I put into it. I know that if I try to do it on my own, I'm going to fail. And the biggest thing, I know that as long as I continue to do the right things and maintain my spiritual relationship with God on a daily basis, that today I have a choice. All those years, I didn't have a choice. Today I have a choice. And I thank you.